This is Cade Massey, practice professor at the Wharton School. On this week's Moneyball Highlights Show, we give you an excerpt from our 10th anniversary special. We sat down, the co-host, the whole crew, to talk about our 10 years doing the show. We're celebrating it this month and reflected on what we've learned, how the world has changed, and some of our favorite moments. Here is the 10th anniversary show.
From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
This is Cade Massey, practice professor here at the Wharton School, sitting with three of my closest faculty colleagues and longtime Wharton Moneyball collaborators. Wharton Moneyball is a show that's been on SiriusXM's Business Radio since its beginning 10 years ago. And we decided, coming up on the 10-year anniversary, we're about a week away. We thought we'd pause, take a moment, and think back on those 10 years, especially because the world's kind of changed in those 10 years. What do we think we've learned from it? I'm sitting with Audie Weiner, professor of statistics, Eric Bradlow, professor of marketing and statistics, and Shane Jensen, professor of statistics as well. A bunch of stats guys. And we've been doing sports analytics.
We're also data science now. We've been added that since we began the show.
Oh, there's a change in the last 10 years. Statisticians have become data scientists, or at least some of them have. Why don't we start there? Why don't we start with the question of how you feel the world of sports analytics has changed in the 10 years? Our first show was March 2014. We've seen a few changes.
I mean, Audie kind of alluded to it a little bit here. I think just sort of the public consciousness of kind of data has really changed a lot. You know, I no longer have to go and explain to people, like, why I'm a statistician,
right,
or why I do, why
right?
I work with data. I think so. I think that really has changed. On the other side, I think sports has also become cooler within the sort of statistical academic community in the time in the last 10 years as well. I was kind of looking back. I started as a faculty in 04. In 05 was the first issue of the Journal of Quantitative Analysis of Sports. When I was first coming up through graduate school, I was interested in sports, but I was cautioned a lot, like, do not, you know, do sports as an academic topic, you know, maybe have it as a side hobby, but don't make it your main thing. And now we've got flagship journals in sports analytics. And I think in the 10 years we've been doing this show, I think, you know, sports has become gone from kind of being this sort of black sheep to this something where this is where you see a lot of the coolest kind of spatial temporal data situations. So it's almost kind of on the cutting edge of methodology now.
It certainly is accepted. I remember when you arrived, that's when I just got tenured at that time. And that was the first time I decided to work on sports. I waited until I had job security before I could work in sports. I wouldn't give that advice anymore. I'd say jump right in.
The field is always going to chase the coolest data. And that's really, I think, the difference that's happened. I think the reality is sports has data that rivals really any other industry today. And I think that's why academia is moving in that direction. I think that's why student interest is there. I think also it's a great testing ground for learning statistical methods.
You know, one particular kind of data that's blown up almost exactly in the window we've been doing this show is spatiotemporal. So the kind of the dawn of that in my mind was when Kirk Goldsberry got the data at Harvard from the NBA. And he ran across Luke Bourne, and I believe that was 2012. That was just preceding our show. So we've been there kind of from the beginning, and we saw this thing blow up, and now it's secondhand.
I think maybe, Kate, to answer your question for me, the part that's gotten most interesting to me is the problems. Meaning, if you think about the original Moneyball, right, it was mainly about on-field stuff. But now if you think about the role of analytics, I'm even thinking about just the papers the people here have written, it's not just the on-field part. It's about the business of sports. It's about, you know, trying to make decisions on sleep and training patterns, et cetera, which is, to me, the narrow set of problems, which was, let's attack, should we go for it on fourth and one? You know, are walks as valuable as singles? I'm not saying those aren't important problems, but the problems have grown so diverse. And that's the part that's exciting to me, and I think that's what's really changed.
I have to say, just I can give you a number. It wouldn't be a statistics show without a number. When I first taught Moneyball Academy, which was our high school sports analytics program over the summer, the first summer we barely had more applicants than we had space. We had 55 applications for 50 spots. This past year, we have two rounds, and we have already 350. I don't think we're going to do a second round. That's just show how incredibly the interest in sports analytics, even at the young level, has just exploded.
One element that you alluded to, Eric, that I think is worth underscoring is that you're so right that in the beginning we were talking about more or less in-game decision-making and personnel. I think the principal third that has evolved really only in the last 7 or 8 years is performance enhancement, performance change. And the classic examples are the Astros bringing in these pitchers and teaching them to throw a different way. And that's a use of technology and analytics that just wasn't happening at all. And it's entirely different from the other two. Okay, that question was about how the field has changed. This next one's more or less how y'all have changed. So what have you learned?
I've learned a lot by listening to all of you. And the thing that kept coming into my mind, since I knew you'd ask the question, was base rates, which is for me to move away from a base rate. You better have a good reason. And also, I was probably one of those people that thought effect sizes was much bigger than I now think it's much smaller. Like, I used to think, well, it's a 90-10 game. You know, Clayton Kershaw and the Dodgers are playing, I don't know, the lowly Pirates. 90% for the Dodgers. No. You'd never predict.
You think you're different now than if you were sitting here 10 years ago?
I do. I think I'm different because
you were a chaired professor of marketing statistics, 47 yes. years old 10 years ago. And you
Why
were
do you
like,
keep bringing up the age? Like, you were 47 10 years ago, too.
As was I.
We're all born in 1967.
I think
Spain.
I was only 37.
I'm not being critical at all. I'm honestly querying. That's phenomenal that's been a consequence of these 10 years.
And I also think I adjusted too much. Like, well, it's a left-handed pitcher against this team.
With momentum.
Yeah, well, momentum we'll get to. I still believe in momentum. Okay. That part hasn't changed. But I believe in base rates, and I don't move off them as far as I think I used to.
So when we started this show, I knew a lot about baseball. But I was really terrified how we were going to fill 2 hours talking about sports that it can't be all about baseball, because what am I going to say? And I've certainly learned a lot about sports. I think everyone is proud of my accomplishments in the football arena in particular, but all sports especially. But the way you're able to do it is basically bring those base rate facts and questions to any sport. Mm. So I might not know anything about golf, but I can contribute by asking, what's the mean? What's the standard deviation? What's a typical player do in these situations? Mm-hmm. And sometimes what I found is my lack of knowledge about a sport works very well with the experts, because it brings you back to earth.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this, too. And actually, it's a little related to what Eric was talking about a little bit, too. I kind of feel like when this show first started, I was trained as a statistician. I feel like I'm decent at probabilistic kind of thinking and thinking in the presence of probability. But I have learned repeatedly over this decade how easy it is for, like, biases and probablistic thinking to creep in. I think of the inevitability kind of bias that I have. You bring it up, like, every college football season, right, where we kind of, like, halfway through the season, we're locked into a national championship game.
No, not that. When he asks at the beginning of the season, what probability do you think is assigned to these four teams?
Yep.
And I'll say, like, 15% of cases, like, it's, like, less than 1%. Like, total overestimation.
And I think I've learned from myself that in situations, especially, like, you know, I think now of, like, you know, the Kansas City Chiefs and their current dynasty, in situations where there's kind of, you know, a dominant team or something like that, my own mind, I tend to, like, when you've got, like, something like a probability of 0.75 or 0.8, you round it up to 1. And so kind of thinking about those sort of like, you know, like even intermediary probability events, like a 20%, you know, a real mismatch in sports would be like an 80 to 20 thing. Thinking, you know, not thinking about that as an inevitable victory, like, you know, thinking about that 20% and kind of processing it, you know, every time you see it. I think that's a lesson I've kind of learned.
I'll give you a couple quick ones. I'm struck by how many times we figure things out collectively. And it's connected to my other one, which is everyone's wrong sometimes. And I've learned that in other environments. One of the nice things about working on faculty is that you see some really smart people be wrong. It's helpful to see that. We're all wrong sometimes. You guys are some of the sharpest guys I have conversations with, and you're all wrong sometimes.
Well, let's just take what the facts are. I'm wrong more than all of you. Because you remember, we've actually...
Yeah,
no. For years, we remember, we've picked outcomes of games and kept scores. I think I have momentum that I'm the lowest every single year we've done. Matter of fact, I don't think we've done this in a few years. Matter of fact, I think it's because you guys want to keep me at the bottom.
That's right.
We need to go back because I'm last place every year. I just tell people I'm in fourth place and like, that sounds impressive. I don't tell them there's only four of us making these predictions.
There was this moment in time, guys, where we were actually pretty much full-time COVID analysts. So March 2020 hit, and we started talking about COVID, making sense of COVID. At some point, we decided we're going to stay on this, and we're going to dedicate the first half hour, I think, of every week to COVID. What are your reflections now? We've shifted back more than 2 years ago now, but it was a long stretch. When you think back on it now,
3 months was an hour.
We didn't have any sports. Remember that?
The beginning. That's right. The first 3 months, it was all pandemic all the time. What reflections do you have on that stretch of Wharton Middle?
I remember it extremely well because I really dived into the data deeply.
You became our expert.
But just, I mean, the lesson that Model Land, the book, which came out much later, we learned on the fly because there were modelers coming out with forecasts for the spread of COVID and forecasts on diseases and on hospitalizations and everything that we wanted. And policy was being built on it. And those forecasts were terrible. And it was the best minds doing the best job with the data they had. And you couldn't do anything.
Couldn't do it.
And it was just an incredible, humbling lesson. Where I was disappointed was that people would put out models with their prediction intervals. And their prediction intervals, nobody's overlapped. And that said to me, this is a problem. If we have 10 different forecasts about where we're supposed to be going down the line, really time series forecasts with confidence bands or prediction bands on top of them, and they were all so depressingly narrow. And we looked at them and this is just bad. So not only were the forecasts bad, but much more importantly, the uncertainty was horribly underestimated. And that just kept appearing over and over again. As we moved through the pandemic, it was almost ridiculously tragic how little we could say with any accuracy.
I was going to say the one thing I remember, though, is that some things were relatively stable. Like what I do remember is, because I remember each week I was the one that was looking at the CDC data and just seeing, like, in some sense, like the death rate conditional on your getting COVID was actually fairly constant for a long period of time. Now, of course, the question is how many people are going to get COVID? Which people are going to get COVID? What's the risk for a certain population? But there was a period where I think the number was somewhere around, I have a vague recollection, maybe it was 1% or 0.8% of 1%, where if you looked at every country and you said, how many people have reported?
Reported, which actual, is hugely important.
I understand. Yeah. Reported and how many people were dying. That number had a very narrow band and interval for a fairly long period of time.
So one thing that was interesting, because we talk about moments, when David Spiegelhalter came in as a guest later.
I was not there that day.
Which he was amazing. He was one of the sharpest minds on COVID earliest on. He had a beautiful infection fatality curve that was by age that turned out to be just about exactly right. And he published that in like March of 2020. And we publicized it on our show and we talked about it. And many people came up to us that we provided solid, good data on COVID that they weren't getting anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I'd like to hear a little bit more from you is like setting aside the vagaries of modeling the pandemic. Mm-hmm. What do we do well? What do we not do well in that show? I mean, did we stay too long? Did we spend too much time, too little time? Like, how did we? Because that was an incredible moment of uncertainty. And I think one of the things we did was we worked together to reduce that uncertainty. We were trying to make sense of it, like together. That's, I think, one of the virtues of what we did. What are your thoughts on the process?
And it gave us a vantage point, at least for me. I mean, it was obviously, I think, probably a frustrating time for all of us, but it was particularly frustrating for me, kind of along kind of, you know, Eric's way of kind of thinking about things. Would you rather have good data, good models, or buy-in? Right. That was a time in society where, although we, you know, could talk and we were mostly focused on evaluating the models, what we really needed was better data. And what we really needed was actual buy-in, you know, on public policy kind of initiatives. Yep. And so it was kind of, I mean, a little bit of therapy for me, but also like, you know, actual like instructive to kind of come in and hear mostly from Audie, like kind of the what was really kind of going on in the kind of modeling sphere. And also to kind of just be able to kind of, I don't know, express both of my kind of frustration, but also interest in what was kind of going on at a societal level at the time through kind of the lens of analytics and through the lens of trying to kind of think about what we could actually measure, you know, without bias, et cetera.
I have to admit, though, I also, when I think back to that period, I also have to think about how I remember thinking to myself how, you know, we're exactly the same age. And so I remember there were times where you would say, yeah, you know what? I would go out and I'd have some sort of party with friends. And I remember I would say it on the air like, oh, I would never have done that.
That was fascinating to me.
And by the way, I don't think of myself as overly risk averse in any particular way. And you were our expert. So all the most of the information I was getting from you, just my interpretation of it was, like, I'm not going to go for that really, even if it's a low probability event, it's just not worth it. And that to me, I will remember all the decisions you guys made And like I was proud, like, wow, I got my like 80th shot. And Adi's like, I don't know if you should be getting that many shots. And I'm like, I've got 80.
So really, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, kind of really, it was a lesson how that distribution of like kind of risk tolerance versus exactly. risk adversity, how much variation there is across people within a person even over time.
Yeah, that was
in that kind of in that. Yeah.
It was fascinating.
Fascinating.
But one of the things we learned about COVID during that time, which has been really useful, is the importance of observational data is distinct from experimental data. And in sports, we talk about confounding. It's just the most important concept in all any evaluation of a complex game where everybody interacts with each other, particularly basketball, soccer, football, much less so baseball, but even that to a degree. And what this forced us to constantly ask when we looked at a study, well, these aren't experiments. And so much public policy and so much discussion right. around COVID was built around observational data, some of it terribly done, some of it better done. And we were able to explain that to our listeners, to each other, and make sense out of it. And this was really one of the most, and I think it really carried us through. It puts front and center, so the scientific method, which is at heart really what statistics is serving, the acquisition of knowledge and truth.
Okay, so everything you said, I have to agree with entirely, of course. But it also feels like one of the things that happened in the pandemic is that experimental evidence by itself was too isolated to really
exactly.
explain what happens in the complicated world. It goes the other direction as well.
We didn't have experiments,
well,
if that's
well,
what you mean.
Well, you can't experiment with, you have a hard time experimenting with societal uptake mm-hmm. of policies. And the biggest confounder, especially early on, was people didn't act the way they were supposed to act in the models. And we wouldn't have known that, I don't think, from an experiment. So in this case, I think it goes, the difficulty is you need to go both ways.
We had to explain this, that why these weren't predictable. What was the issues? And we did, I think that was one of our strongest points.
Within the field of statistics, as you know, nobody would consider me an expert specifically in causal inference. That's mm-hmm. not really the domain I operate
right.
in. But I kind of felt like, you know, when I was having with my friends and kind of with the lay people I was talking to, like having to explain just kind of very basic what you can learn from an experiment, what you can not learn from, you know,
what an observational study is, and a controlled observational study.
Yeah.
All right, guys, let's shift out of the pandemic and do a lightning round before we end up with a couple of final questions. Lightning round, back to favorite moments, but let's look at some specific narrow aspects of the show. Any favorite guest moments or interviews? Any things jump out to you over the years? We've talked about some so far. I mean, you've had some big baseball guys. Did you just love having by any chance?
We had Ron Bloomberg, which I enjoyed immensely.
I don't know if Matt was the producer then, but Sam Gwynn wrote a book about Hal Mumme, the famous football coach who was kind of the beginning of the air raid. And Sam Gwynn... And so we had him on the show. I didn't know he was going to be on the show. I had just read an earlier book of his that is really about the history of Texas that was profound for me. And I come in some Wednesday morning, and Matt's lined up Sam Gwynn for the interview segment. I'm like, oh, my God, this guy just wrote this amazing book. Just random, mm-hmm. you know, pleasure. Any other guests jump out?
Well, when we were on Radio Row for one of the Super Bowl, I think the Super Bowl in Miami, and we got to interview Justin Tuck on the show, and I was wearing the same Tom Brady coat, and just the absolute look of disgust on his face was kind of a amazing moment. That was a great interview, too, because, again, Justin Tuck, you know, he's not, I don't think, the most, you know, necessarily analytically minded, like, athlete, but it was a really informative kind of discussion because we talked a lot about, you know, I mean, he was, you know, on the defense that went up against some great teams in the Super Bowl, and just sort of the way he thought about, you know, battling Brady and the way he thought about other quarterbacks, I just remember it being a really cool discussion. Mm-hmm.
I loved also the moments we've talked about. We could call them the more secondary sports, like when we've had people on golf talk about the golf analytics and, you know, like the smarter players know where to forget. They know they're going to be inaccurate. So they choose a zone that they're not going to cause themselves as much damage. Like you could go for the left side of the green, but you know you should shoot for the right side of the green because here's how much variance there is in your shot. That's something that really has always stuck with me.
That was one of my most eye-opening interviews. I'd forgotten about that. That was one of those moments where I'm listening to this guy talk, and it's Scott Fawcett. Scott Fawcett golf coach. He played some golf coach now in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And we chase him down because of an article in the newspaper, and he starts talking on our show about these guys have to act like they're going to hit it perfectly because you got to have confidence, but they have to plan knowing that they can't hit it perfectly, right. Even the best golfers in the world. He was talking about accepting uncertainty and accommodating uncertainty in your decision-making. It was absolutely profound moment. Loved it.
So I have a few, but I remember some of my favorites were David Epstein. He's written two of my favorite books on sports. One is The Sports Gene, and I interviewed him about that book. I may have been alone. This was a long time ago. And then he had a second book, Range, which he talked to us about the importance of athletes trying out different sports and how that's important for success. That was just, those were incredible interviews. And then, of course, I remember Annie Duke's first interview with us. She came live in the studio. She was writing a book, Thinking in Bets. And she talked about poker and reading opponents. And I remember one thing she said to us, and she's been on many times. She comes to my Moneyball Academy every summer. But she talked about how the importance of exactly the opposite of what we do, which is, you know, calmly think about data and regress. But when you're in a poker tournament, you got to size up that opponent immediately. You don't have time to wait and watch their play and accumulate data and move yourself off the prior. You've got to look at everything they do, how they touch their chips, how they talk to each other to quickly figure out what type of player. Because if you get it wrong, you're going to get hammered. And it's like very observable, just the expertise that goes into being a professional poker player that's much more beyond just the strategy of just doing
that. I remember that, too. It was super insightful. I kind of found myself coming back to that because, you know, it was really about what she's talking about is like very subtle body language that as kind of a professional in the field, you learn, you know, you really immerse yourself in. When coming out of COVID, one thing, or going through COVID and coming out of it, I kind of, for my own teaching, I realized just how much I feed off the body. Like you are subtly measuring the body language of people, like teaching in front of people in person is a very different kind of endeavor because you can read the body language of people and very subtle.
You know, I could perceive what I was picking up on in very sort of subtle signs. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably, you know, for poker players that kind of become that as their vocation, that it almost becomes probably second nature in a way I didn't even realize I was doing it as a teacher.
Okay, last lightning round question. What about non-sports? Other than the pandemic, we do sometimes wander off the playing fields into other areas. Any favorite non-sport moments? And to give y'all a moment to think about it, I'll tell you my favorite. It's the Moneyball for Fire guys.
Yeah, the Forest Fire guys. Oh, is what I was thinking of.
We just
I know
literally,
you love them.
We hypothesized that they must. This was the summer of, I think it might have been 2020, and bad forest fires in the American Northwest. And we thought someone is running analytics on that. And we asked Matt to run it down, and he's like, "Sure, I found these guys who were publishing papers, one of which is called Moneyball for Fire." And now we have a multi-year relationship with these guys we've had on the show multiple times. And they fight the same battles, the exact same culture battles that we see fought in football organizations, basketball organizations, baseball organizations. It's incredible.
So yeah, I mean, talk about a cool spatial temporal data situation that basically pops up every year. That's and right. Links to so much of the kind of climatic things that are going on right now as well. It's
one of my favorite non-sports topics was the traffic engineer we had on years ago, right before Thanksgiving. You may not remember
I don't
this.
Think I was on this show.
You may not have been on it. But I wasn't alone. I know there was a few of us there.
I think I remember that.
And he was talking about essentially Moneyball for designing highways. And one of his comments was that we in America don't do things properly. We just build wider roads when we want to accommodate more traffic. But that can be accomplished by learning how to drive.
Oh, really?
We just don't drive properly.
Huh.
And he explained the various ways. In principle, he was saying, stay out of the left lane unless you're passing, and how much trouble that causes. And he explained how the models show how your roads become inefficient when people drive improperly. And he was, of course, saying, but in Germany, where he was a German engineer, we don't build wide roads. We teach people to drive properly.
Speaking of Germans, we have the diet researcher out of Duke, whose name I'm going to forget, but he's given us some great stuff over the years on calories, like really good stuff. All right, we need to wrap up, and so I want to ask one last question. We've been talking about the last 10 years, of course, and appropriately. Hopefully we'll do another 10 years and more in front of us. What is one hope you have or ambition you have for the show over the next 10 years?
I think it's going to be really cool 5, 6, 7 years from now when we all have Hall of Fame votes and we can on the air. We argue about the Hall of Fame for weeks every year. Won't it be great as voting members to do that?
I'd like us to do an offsite at the Hall of Fame. I mean, I'm saying that's baseball Hall of Fame, but a matter of fact, we could do all of them. I mean, actually, you can actually do the baseball, basketball, football Hall of Fame in one swing. I mean, it's not that far from each other, the major sports. I don't even know, where's the hockey Hall of Fame?
But Toronto.
All right, well, it's not totally out of the question.
That sounds like a really fun
trip. But either way,
I
have such a passion for the history of baseball especially and the baseball Hall of Fame that I think it would be great to do a show from there. And I'm confident that we could get a number of Hall of Famers to come on the air. And I'm sure they would talk to us about the role that analytics played in their careers. And it would be great to get a spectrum, you know, getting someone whose major career was in the 70s and 80s in the pre-analytics era, then get someone in the 90s and 2000s when it was emerging, and then get even the most recent Hall of Famers. That would be a ton of fun.
Yeah, I mean, sorry to just piggyback on that. Like, as I was sort of thinking about the last 10 years, I feel like we do kind of, you know, because we've been doing this a while, I think we have a historical perspective on things. I would like us to do even more of a kind of like, you know, this year, like, you know, 10 years ago, what was going on, both in like sports itself and also in analytics. You know, I think so many people, you know, the field has moved so quickly in, say, the last 20 years that, you know, kind of like, you know, we're the last keepers of the generation without internet or whatever. We have an obligation to remind people what it was like and where we
Well, Shane, what we may find out in the next 10 years is, you know, Adi was talking about, you know, running more sophisticated models. Maybe artificial intelligence and these large language models are going to change the way we do even sports analytics. Like, maybe we're going to be able to just upload a massive amount of video and other stuff and just say, you know, run, you know, compress this using a variation encoder and just run some analysis on this, and it'll get automatically done. I have a feeling that 10 years from now, the use of video data and other types of data will be much more prevalent in sports because of all these technology and AI that's going on.
I think that's a fascinating prediction. I have to second Eric's Hall of Fame show. I mean, we're kind of a force in this department. It's my obsession, and just because of loving baseball and baseball history in particular. So I'm just seconding that one. But if I had to say I'd like to see something in the next 10 years, I'd like us to reflect a little bit about what's happened on the sports analytics side, kind of on the research end, and kind of reflect on our particular area, which is the academic contribution of sports analytics and methods. And just reflect on some of the great papers, the great contributors, interview some of the scientists involved. We haven't done too much of that. We do the new stuff. We're very good with new, but we haven't had the opportunity, maybe it's my bias, of reflecting historically about what's happened and kind of not a time-based moment, but, you know, talk to some of the people who are really involved in pushing our subject forward.
All right. That was our conversation. That was our pause in the Wharton Moneyball experience to think about the last 10 years. Appreciate you guys being here for it. Appreciate your listening to us all these years. Appreciate the guests and the comments and the ideas you've given us. We are better because of it. We are thankful for the last 10 years, and we very much look forward to many more to come.